This is a HeadGum Podcast.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, of course, hyping it up. Season 4, they're gonna do one more. Season 5, Maisel Hive, rise up and be alive. That's right.
Mush on the bed.
Ford and Ford, go forward. Here we are. Maren Hinkle, Tony Shalhoub, give me the lube. Let's fuck. Okay.
Working at the Wolfer. Titties everywhere.
Welcome to the much delayed and much anticipated Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goy's season 4 finale, covering episodes 407 and 408. I am Kevin. And who the heck are you? No, you're not. Come on.
I've been Kevin for longer than you can even imagine, dude.
She keeps dipping out of frame like she's afraid of the microphone. She's like, no,
I'm afraid of, well, I'm afraid of a lot of things, and I think you know that. I am Alice Wetterland, and this is the finale.
This is the finale. For now.
Of all finales. I also dip out of frame because I burp.
Oh, she's doing her burpees. She's an active
woman. I've got my co-fefe. By the way, this is my impression of Kevin doing, trying to decide what time to do this podcast. With me, he was like, you want to do 9 a.m.? You want to do 9 a.m.?
No, here's my impression of me trying to schedule this podcast with Alice. Hey, how about Thursday or Friday? I'm sorry, Kevin. I'm busy for 9 days straight. So we will not be able to release our season 4 finale in time sequentially with the rest.
I told you that this might happen when we started.
That's a toxic relationship. I told you I was going to be a lot. I told
that's
you that I was going to be a...
What? Is it the same?
It's the same thing. You warned someone. I said
it's
I was going to hurt you and cheat on you. And so it's your fault for letting it happen.
Well, when Kevin asked me, to be fair, to do this podcast for this season, I said, I'm going to cheat on you. And he was like, what?
She did. And have you so far? Have you cheated on me?
Not really. I've done like some really sort of obscure entertainment podcasts that, not obscure, but obscure to us and our podcasting world.
Yeah, but it was just above the close stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then I don't care. It's fine. And there's forgiveness and redemption to be found here. And we are going to talk about sex a good amount.
Have you heard of 18-inch Journey?
No. What's that?
It's this thing that Garrett sent me. It's like it's worship music. And it's like a bunch of hipsters making worship music. And the song is like, come a little deeper. Like, come a little deeper over and over and over again. And it's just like, and it's called 18-inch Journey.
18-inch
Journey. And it's so
confusing.
Journey. And like, it's really confusing and confounding whether or not the band is in on the joke or not.
Well, I'm going to the website right now. It looks like it's a whole campus and a sort of like maybe low-key church in North Carolina. This is
high-key church.
Okay, it's a high-key church. I don't know where the inches come in. But okay, here we are. Well, that's something for my other podcast, Alice. I don't think we should.
I know. Well, there you go. I'm a resource,
and I appreciate it. Yeah, that is nice of you. You did that show like 5 years ago. It's been so
I know
long.
That was a really fun time. I loved it. We went to the fucking Galleria,
the Americana, but we parked at the Galleria.
Americana,
the beautiful Americana,
which is right next door. To be fair to me,
that's right. No, I said to
the Glendale Galleria.
So it's the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, guys. It's the season 4 finale. coming at you, trying roughly to follow the, you know, order and sequence. I do like that we combined the two episodes in a weekly release schedule. I think that made for good, fun conversation.
That's for us to pat ourselves in the back.
We had a great time with our friend Paul last week, or however many weeks ago.
That was really fun. Little guest drop in.
Yeah, a little. And, you know, he has the link for today. I do hope he takes advantage of it and bombs it.
Did you send it to him?
I mean, again, he has it from last time. It. Yeah. And I said, you know, come bomb at any time. That should be like, you know, there's a lot of podcasts that kind of revolve around the premise of an open door policy, but a podcast that actually has one where, hey, we're all recording, and then you send a group chat or, you know, a BCC email to 90 people. We're recording from this to this today. Here's the Zoom link if you want to hop on, and it'll record you. That would be a fun idea.
I love that.
Wouldn't that be fun?
It's like an Instagram Live.
Yeah.
Can I say I have a concept for a podcast, and you could tell me whether or not it's a good idea. And this is like, this is a new segment on this show where I pitch ideas to Kevin, who is the expert of all podcasts, and then he gives it a score of how many hat sales at what's the store Midge worked at?
Oh, Bloomingdale's, I want to say.
I didn't work at Bloomingdale's. Come on, man.
Target? What? I have to wear a red shirt. I don't know. What was the store? B. Dalton.
B. Altman, oh my God. Maybe? Why didn't you not know that right away? My world is shaking.
I don't
know.
Now.
So anyway, how many hat sales at B. Dalton?
Okay.
1 out of 5.
Okay.
So this is the idea. I want to make I very rarely at this point watch things that, like, high quality content. I only watch things that I can make fun of.
Sure.
Like movies, and maybe it's half and half. Like, I will watch, you know. But so when I do that, I like to do bits and make fun of characters and make up a whole thing. And so I was thinking of doing a show where I spoil movies entirely because I don't think the movie deserves to not be spoiled.
Okay.
Like, that's my opinion. So don't watch it if you want, you know. Like, you know how those YouTube recaps where they go like, this happens, then this happens, then this happens, then this happens, and they do clips from the thing?
Mm-hmm.
It's that. It's a Twitch show with me doing animated interstitials, which I would do live on the Twitch show of like,
you
this
can
is
do
this
live
character
animation?
In this situation. Yeah, it's like using like very, very rudimentary like green screen stuff, not like me doing a mocapping or whatever, but like I'm the character on a green screen and I'll put on a little fake costume or whatever, like a hat, you know.
Okay, so this is so far not a podcast. This is a visual show on Twitch.
Okay, so this is the pitch. It's like I do like kind of an interactive sort of like review of the movie. Like I would do this with Knights in Rodanthe, for instance, which is a show I have so many bits about prepared and I never have anywhere to put them.
Mm-hmm. This is a Diane Lane romantic movie.
The Diane Lane, Richard Gere. And like, I have whole like multi-character bits worked out where I play all the characters. Like, and it's like vignettes inside of a movie world, but you have to be sort of you have to know the context of the movie a little bit to be able to appreciate the bit.
Sure.
So for those who've seen it, it's fine. And it actually would be helpful to have a refresher probably. But for those who haven't seen it, I want to create like a movie recap with like audio bits inside of it.
Okay. So a recap show in which there's enough context of whatever the source material is that the listener, the viewer has enough information to know that the references you're making are funny.
Yeah. It's like, how did this get made? But just with one person. Like me, just me doing the whole
thing.
There's
no guests. There's no co-host.
No guests, never. Wow. It's 100% me.
Now, this is a one-woman show that you're kind of describing
it's a one-woman
in some
show.
Ways. Wow. This is unprecedented, at least to my ears. I'm trying to think of a recap show in which it was just one person carrying the weight the whole time, other than this one.
I like those videos on YouTube where you go and you're like, what happened in this movie? And then some guy from Australia is like, that's when he went big. And discovered there was no more disillusion cubes. Ooh. And he had to grow his own vampire energy or whatever. Like, you're just like...
Well, what? Those are particularly helpful with this gap of television shows now where it's like...
I know.
Here's what happened last time on Ozark, because it was 4 years ago that the last season
And apparently every show is just like, anyway, that's what, like, they're just acting like there wasn't a gap.
Yeah, well, because this is the only moment in time in which there will have been a gap. In 20 years, right. It'll just be someone accessing a library, and then it's like, all right, the next tile, and the time will be compressed. So I don't disagree with that as a strategy. I think you've criticized that before of like, why don't they acknowledge the gap? But it's
you can
like
acknowledge or don't acknowledge the gap in the writing of the show itself. But like, we also have created already and have a structure to address Last Week On.
Mm-hmm.
We don't not have that. There's not like, there's never been done. They could just do like a Previously On.
Yeah, it is. I think streamers probably don't do that as much now.
They don't
nowadays.
Do it as much, but like, this is an instance in which you might wanna.
Mm-hmm. I know. Like, God, HBO still does that. I think maybe some streamers used to do that and you had the option of skipping them.
Instead, we're giving like a cottage industry to guys in New Zealand for some reason. Like,
wait, what's wrong with guys in New Zealand? You got a problem with them? You got a problem with them, man?
All right.
Anyway, I think I give it 3 hat sales. No, I'll give it 4 hat sales. I think
Thank
it is.
You.
I think it's a fun idea just because if you could pull it off in a compressed way, I would not want the show to be longer than 28 minutes, any episode. If you can do it in that amount of time, I feel like anything more could be a little tiresome, especially when it's just one person, because I think the benefit of longer shows and even shows like this, oftentimes it's like the conversation goes long because it's actually a conversation. When it is one person giving you a thing, that's hard to receive in anything more than half hour increments, in my just anecdotal consumer opinion.
Okay, so for listeners at home, Kevin said I'm only tolerable in 28 minute increments, so... Just
right, but
that.
With me, you're tolerable in about an hour and a
File
half.
File that away yeah. in our resentment filing cabinet that we have.
That's so nice that you bought me that filing cabinet. And I don't resent you for that. It's the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goys. It's the season 4 finale. We're wrapping it up. Season 5's coming. We got one more. They are currently shooting season 5. It's shooting in New York right now. So there will not be the 2-year-long break that there was between seasons 3 and 4. We're going to go straight into it.
What if they just did anyway?
We're like,
yeah, we'll do it again.
We're just going to age it in post-production like a fine wine. So there won't be that sort of gap. And so we can take this episode of the podcast to talk about these two episodes, 407 and 408, but then just to kind of give a little retrospective, our thoughts and feelings, what went wrong, what went right with the season, highlights, lowlights, things of that nature. This is the COVID season of the show. Amy and Dan did a post-mortem interview, like a sit-down with the Hollywood Reporter, and they said, yeah, this was our COVID season. And they talked about how they got self-conscious and they did not have as much fun filming the show in this season because they wanted to travel more and instead they had to do more on-set stuff like at the, what is it called, the Wilford? The strip club. And they returned to the same sets over and over again. They said they felt claustrophobia, but they didn't.
I like the idea that Dan and Amy are like ultra spoiled at this point where they're like, if we don't have the freedom to literally shoot, like have an episode on Mars directed by God, then... We kind of just have to recycle old Gilmore Girls scripts.
Recycle old Gilmore Girls scripts. Now, Alice, I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about, but maybe you can tell me later in the
Why
show.
Why did you drop
out of
Yale?
Tony Bennett's show?
Why did you drop out of Yale, 20 Bennett? 20 Bennett?
20 Bennett.
Bennett is a sick rapper name. If somebody out there listening to Gilmore Girls
20 Bennett
has... any interest in having like a kind of early aughts rapper name, I would say 20 Bennett is pretty great.
I don't know if you heard 20 Bennett's feature on Max Medeznut's new mixtape, but it's really good.
It's mostly him just being like, yo, what is Tony Bennett famous for? What's his famous song?
What's Tony Bennett's famous song?
I don't give a shit. Don't fucking look at me like I give a shit about Tony Bennett, okay? Any
yeah,
of those
but it's
fucking
not,
weird rap.
I don't know. I left my
world.
Heart in San Francisco.
So I have a fucking stand-up joke where I just diss Frank Sinatra. So like don't Tony Bennett at me.
I'm not trying to be raucous about it. It's just I think it's bizarre that you think Tony Bennett's voice is yo.
No, I'm just saying like I'm gonna do a trap version of what his famous catchphrases or lyrics are.
So it'd be like I left my dick in San Francisco.
I can't get any help with my bits.
I told you. I said that his most famous song is "I Left My Heart in San Francisco." Alice.
I left my heart.
Yeah.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
Yeah. Left my heart.
That is his. I thought that was like a folk song.
It's fun to not know things, isn't it? It's fun to not be a snob about anything.
Night and Day.
I mean, that was his most famous song. I think what he's most famous for now is being propped up against his will by Lady Gaga on their duets albums.
Oh, that's right. He's in the labyrinth, as they say.
Yeah, he's pretty sick. He's got the allsies, and it is wild to have pop culture references and characters in this show that are still with us to this day on Earth and are still alive, at least as of recording this.
But they have to be diminished mentally enough that they won't know what's going on.
Yes. Then shouts out to, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, the star of Rory Gilmore's Dreams and Gilmore Girls, who did pass away as of recording this yesterday. Somewhere Rory Gilmore's having a weird dream about her tonight and going to heaven. You remember that, the Madeleine Albright dream in Gilmore Girls?
Vaguely.
So in
my mind might have pushed it out to make space for anything else.
Yeah, for like Tony Bennett's greatest hits. In season one of Gilmore Girls, I think it's the Roy's birthday episode, Lorelai crawls into her bed and kind of tells her the story of her birth in graphic detail, and it's a very cute, sweet scene. And then I believe in season six, Rory has a dream, and it's the exact same scene again, but instead of Lorelai, it's Madeleine Albright doing like, "And then I was screaming and giving you birth." It was a clever way to do a celebrity cameo in a show like that. I thought it was really interesting and kind of funny. So, rip to a war criminal, probably. I don't know. I'm not going
to
Google that.
Rip to a war criminal. I mean, it's not Margaret Thatcher, is it?
No, it's not Margaret Thatcher. Alice, should we do our Amazon Prime synopses real fucking quick?
Okay.
Okay. 407, it's called Ethan Esther Heim. Abe forgets his tobacco. Joel raises a glass with Moish. Midge learns firsthand about America's bicameral system of legislature. 408 is, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Midge and Joel debate Greek mythology. Susie finds a second phone line. A blizzard brings unexpected consequence, and it's time once again for a segment that we freaking call
12 o'clock rock, we're gonna
pop
around
culture
tonight.
Pop around the culture for one last time in season four. We take every pop culture reference amongst these two episodes, put them in a supercut. This is 407-408, pop around the freaking culture.
Mine's clean as Anita Bryant.
Vivian Leigh on the cover of Time. Back to the bedroom. Eleanor Roosevelt driving a Jeep. Back to the bedroom. Lassie licking her privates. Back to the bedroom.
And that sexy Robert Goulet.
She's John F. Kennedy's wife.
Bing Crosby.
Bonnie and Clyde. Romeo and Juliet.
Like I'm Henry VIII?
Tarzan and Jane? You really want to put your son in a loincloth?
Does Alfie do birthday parties?
Only if it's Billy Wilder's.
I mean, how much fun is it sitting through Casablanca if you already know Ingrid Bergman isn't ending up with Humphrey Bogart?
Fill me on what's going on with Castro and the rebels.
Writing love letters to Sandy Koufax.
Just like Albert Einstein.
There's a performance of Haydn's trumpet concerto with original period instruments.
The white woman is Kate Smith. Black woman is Lena Horne.
Innocent, get Roy Cohn on the phone right now.
Mickey Mouse, a known anti-Semite.
The greatest threat to American decency since Mantovani records.
He is Nikolai Koklov, and we are Russia.
The guy in the Bible that killed his father.
I don't know, Abraham?
No, he was the one who almost killed his son.
Absalom.
No, it didn't start with an A. Oedipus?
That's not the Bible.
But he killed his father.
And married his mother.
Well, other than that, I'm that guy.
Joel.
You look like one of the Walendas balancing there like that.
I got a call from Tony Bennett's people.
Have you ever seen The Twilight Zone? It's a terrific program.
Wait, isn't Florian Ziegfeld dead?
Yep.
Florian Ziegfeld.
Yep.
Alphabetically, the last one. There's a few pop culture references I didn't quite get. I had to look up the... Luke Kirby, Lenny Bruce says to Midge in the hotel room, you're looking like one of the Walendas, like one of the flying Walendas.
Yeah.
Which was apparently a little circus troupe. The flying Walendas. No, I did look this up. I'm going to look it up again real quick. The flying Walendas, it's a circus act group of stunt performers who perform, you know, high wire acts, you know, they were first known as the Great Walendas, but the current name was coined by the press in the 1940s. So they've been around. They've been around for quite a while.
I guess.
So what What do you mean, I guess?
I don't know. Kevin's not, just keep going. We have so much to cover. I don't know why I'd even interjected. There's so much more I want to say.
Well, what do you want to say first and foremost?
All right. Well, there was a lot of, this is what I'll say. There's a lot of moments in both of these episodes where I thought the comedy was a return to form that I did appreciate. There was a bunch of things where it's like, it actually made me feel like the last sewed you and I did, where we kind of were like, I guess this is it now. This is what the show is. You know what I mean? Like when we lowered our expectations, or at least I did, it made it possible for me to enjoy the show a bit more, because there was some stuff that happened that I thought was really freaking funny. Like I thought the thing that happened in the beginning of episode 7 when Archie gets the money stolen from.
That was wild. Yes. So
it was really funny.
Archie,
I laughed out loud.
Archie is trying to deposit some money, and a guy in a motorcycle just flies by and takes it from him.
Instantly.
Yeah. It was like, perfect. Well,
the timing is really funny of some of the things. And some of the stuff that's uniquely physical comedy of ASP, like when they're raiding the strip club. The girl's like, I can't find my earring. I can't find my earring. And Boise's like, you don't need it. And she's really upset about the earring. And then he just puts a bunch of feather boas on her and she just stays down.
Here was my thought during the raid. And then kind of to your point about Archie getting the money stolen from him. This is something a listener brought up too. It feels like the Palladinos as directors are so good now. Their sense of blocking, timing, pace, visuals is pretty technically excellent. It makes me excited one day to, and maybe more so than another TV show, look forward to whatever the movie is, whatever the ASP movie is that she does. Especially in The Raid, there's just like, there's always a showiness and there's the, you know, fondness for one-ers and long takes and things of that nature. But blocking is one of those invisible crafts of, oh, it's hard to stage things in a way that emotionally makes sense and makes sense for the performers and makes sense for you, the viewer. And I was just kind of impressed by some of that stuff. A listener did bring up in the Q&A, like, is their directing ability in inverse proportion to their writing ability? Have they become better directors and worse writers in some way? And maybe that is the case. But it is, because they were and are writers first and foremost. This is not a trick everyone can do. Aaron Sorkin should not direct his own stuff. And yet he has been for the last couple of movies that he's done. Mm. But Amy should direct her own scripts.
Right.
Yeah. It's not just like a writer reverse engineering herself to a director's chair. It's like, I would watch her direct someone else's stuff too. Like, I feel like she'd be good at it.
What's the musical she was going
to
do?
She was going to do a remake of Gypsy. At the time, it was rumored to have Melissa McCarthy attached to it.
Okay. So I have an idea. Instead of a remake of Gypsy, you know what would be really great? If Amy could write a movie about a production of Gypsy.
Okay, this is interesting.
You know, like, I like the backstage-iness. I like her going, like, the like endless, like, a story revolving the making of a thing is very ASP. You know, the, like, let's put on a show is so ASP that she should just do a story of making a theater, you know, production.
Well, there's a... Oh, you're saying a theater, just a production of Gypsy.
Like Christopher Guest, you know.
Oh, like, so almost kind of like kind of Noises Off, if you're familiar with that. Have you watched that play before or that movie?
No.
From the 80s? So Noises Off is a show within a show. The whole premise of
it's
a group of actors. They're putting on a show. Act one, you basically see the show that they're putting on in a rehearsal run through. Act two is you know, see them behind the scenes. And then act three, I believe it's like a mix of both. But yeah, that might
something
be a
like
good,
that.
Yeah,
and that would enable her to write it. You know, like have her break a story within the telling of the story. So you know, like it would give her enough like elbow room.
Yeah.
To do her own thing, but also it's like the perfect format.
Right, in a way that feels iterative. It's really hard, especially for a musical that's really well known and beloved, to do any sort of like adaptation or. Addition to it that feels interesting.
Now that when I watch musicals, it's all about like musicals are so for me like the flimsiest of fourth walls.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think about like doing numbers, dance numbers in the middle of speaking and how awkward that is of a transition that all I can think about is what's going on behind the scenes during those. So I just want to see it.
Did you watch the new West Side Story?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-oh. Sounds like you may not have been a fan.
Did I answer too quickly? No. Actually, West Side is sort of... Because it's like... It's like musically ambitious in a way that I appreciate, but then like some of the songs are like, hey, did you just not come into work that day? Or like, and then some of the songs are like incredible. Like America as a song is like layered and it has notes of like.
That's so interesting. To me, West Side Story is only bangers except for one. There's one song that's limp. It's One Hand, One Heart, the little One Hand, One Heart.
I don't
when they're
mind
in the church.
One Hand, One Heart. It's to me, it's the boy, it's the
cool
crazy boy.
That's
I
so
hate
funny.
That song
to me, that's the most exciting one.
I think
in
that
the new
song
one
was written by cocaine.
I mean
100%. And it's
it could be
garbage.
In 1950s Brooklyn. But I bring that up because I find that to be a really great work of adaptation. Tony Kushner wrote the script for that movie. And while still
Kushner.
Being Kushner, I don't know if you've hit the Kush recently, but he knows how to write a script really well. And he did, I thought, a phenomenal work of adaptation with that, where it became about gentrification. It became about, you know, anybody's was an explicitly trans character. It became about like this meta narrative and giving, you know, somewhere to Rita Moreno instead of like a duet as it is in the original. All that shit I thought was like really interesting as a reframing. So yeah, maybe ASP could do that. Could do that with
Rita Moreno
Gypsy.
Was so good that I feel like watching the movie. I just love Rita Moreno already so much. So there's that. But fuck, I fucking love Rita Moreno so much. And I loved her interactions with Ansel Morgenstern, or whatever the fuck that guy's name is.
Ansel Morgenstern.
Honestly, that guy is so interchangeable with so many other Ansel Elgort. And there's another one, the guy who played, I guess, Han Solo.
Alden Ehrlich.
They're like the same guy to me. There's like 100 of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like squishy face white dudes. I don't care about them at all.
Alden Ehrenreich. There's Alden Ehrenreich, Ansel Elgort, and then Ty Sheridan. He also looks like
do
them.
We need this? Yeah, like do one gotta go. Do you know what I'm saying?
One gotta go. Yeah, no, I do know what you're saying. One gotta go.
It's fucking squishy face white guy.
So this is definitely
the fuck out of here.
The low-key, one of the low-key narratives of season four is, hey, what if we just did a Gilmore reunion and brought back a lot of your old friends and familiar faces. Scott Cohen, Max Mendez, nuts.
One of
Digger,
the most disappointing.
Chris Eigenman, Kelly Bishop as you know, the mafia matchmaker matron
successful,
of Manhattan. I would say the most successful out of
yes.
The hey, remember this person?
Yeah.
And finally, in 407, after how much whatever online speculation
Ballyhoo.
And set photos and yes, ballyhoo teases and whatnot, we do see Milo Ventimiglia's character. His character's name is Handsome Man. He is in the show for all of 2 minutes or 90 seconds, and I believe he has two lines in it.
Deeply hated this whole thing.
So 407, it opens with this sort of story that Midge is telling about how she got involved with a man at the park that she would see a lot. And then she's telling it, retelling it. A lot of this is taking place in a sort of montage format. You're not hearing their conversations. You're just hearing her narration of it. Turns out, you know, they go back to his place, they have sex, and then his wife comes home and yells at them, and turns out he's not such a good guy. It is utterly baffling to me that this was cast as Milo Ventimiglia, one of the more, just like, a loaded face figure and actor in the Paladino verse, certainly, but also someone who's like, God damn, this guy's the fucking goods now, in a way that's like, this should have been a that guy day player, handsome boy that maybe you saw in Billions season 3, and you're trotting out Milo for this. It felt like a favor.
And then also a favor to who?
It would be him doing a favor to them, like, yeah, I'm in New York
yeah,
for a
not
day.
Not to the viewer. And certainly the story suffered, the joke suffered immensely from having such a weighty person.
Yes.
In that scenario, because whatever happens, you're going to be like, oh, that was it? Instead of appreciating what might have been an interesting joke that supported story later on, you can't. And they know this. So why? It just was terrible.
I think that's an interesting thing. It must be so... Because look, they've known this boy for 20 plus years,
this
right?
Boy.
you know,
crazy
like they,
boy.
They cast him in Gilmore.
Cool it boy, you know?
Cool it boy, like in 2000, 2001. And to them, he's probably just like this kid that they know. And like, yeah, he's gone on.
Yeah.
He's actually had a lot of success on This Is Us. And he does all these movies now. But to him, they seem to have, you know, a genial enough relationship. Yeah, he does A Year in the Life during his hiatus from his big show. And yeah, he'll come on. Like, it's almost such a fundamental misunderstanding of casting power, where if you were the casting director of a movie, and I've worked as a casting director a lot. I worked on a movie called Super Mario Brothers I cast Chris Pratt for, and I was really happy with the choices I made.
Yeah, I thought you did a good job, actually.
Thank you so much.
You know, you had some options that were various, and you picked what you thought was best, and I think it bears out.
I think it bears out too. Thank you so much. But if you were casting, like, okay, this guy's fifth on the call sheet, he's going to be a supporting character, you would not say, I don't know, like Tom Hanks. It'd be like, well, if Tom Hanks is that guy, everyone's going to be like, why is Tom Hanks here? There's just like a certain wattage that
and
is just...
And contextually, this is Tom Hanks.
In the Paladinoverse, the goodwill is the same. Yes, you're right.
There's a way to cameo. And it's not in this thing what's like a hat on a hat on a hat on a hat on a B. Altman hat sale. It's just not like that. That's not the way to cameo. If he's going to be in it as a cameo, have him cameo. Have him be the guy that works behind the counter, like at the pizza shop or whatever, you know? But then don't tease it.
Well, it's also this funny thing of, because there's so much love and adoration for this actor and for the characters that he's played in their shows, there might even be a sense of betrayal of like, what if he was a philandering womanizer who cheated on his wife? It's like, no, that's our cute little Milo. Why are you doing that to him?
I can see that being Milo.
You could in real life?
I could see that being Milo suggesting to ASP or something and being like, I want to play a bad guy.
Oh, I see.
I could see that happening.
That might be it. You know, in that postmortem I was telling you about in the Hollywood Reporter, they talked about some of the rationale behind that. So Daniel says, for Milo, we needed that cameo role, but we needed somebody with weight. There were a lot of guys that were submitted to us, but for this kind of story, you needed someone to bring a lot of weight with them. Amy says, and the charm and the face, the Milo effect. When Milo walks on stage, there's a Milo effect. Daniel says, and then Chris is someone that we've stayed friends with. It's just like very odd that they were like, yeah, it's the Milo effect. So I guess they were aware of like the quote unquote Milo effect, but I think they didn't maybe employ it in quite the most successful way.
Yeah, I mean, a disaster.
Yeah, whereas like Eigenman and Scott, like all those, and even Liza Weil last season as the trumpet player, all those are like, oh yes, this makes sense. This is like a nice thing to see. It's satisfying to see Kelly Bishop as a fucking criminal lady in this show.
It's satisfying. And the Eigenman, like the guy who works at The Voice, like it's a small part, but it resonates. And he gets to do his thing, right? Mm-hmm. He gets to have his phone call with the, you know, the New York Times and have his thing and be that guy. And that's right. And then for Milo, like, the other thing is, like, Milo is employed exclusively in the Paladino universe as a leading man, romantic interest that is, like, always deeply sort of involved with the feminine heroine. So you kind of can't, what is he going to do? How is Milo going to come flex and do his thing if he's not doing that?
Yeah. You wish it was someone where it's like, there might be an opportunity for them to return as well as there are for all these other characters and veterans of the universe. Because really the only reason this story exists, and it is quite a turn of like, you know, Midge's, not promiscuity, but just like a little romance for her. It's really just a setup so she can do bad stand-up and make Jackie cry, to make Jackie Kennedy cry at a fundraiser by talking about infidelity and what it means to be the other woman in a scene that's very odd and almost feels...
It felt confusing.
Yeah, it feels not worth talking about.
You know
all
what it's
that
like?
Stuff.
It's like, this is the stupidest metaphor, but like, you know how those guys that like control the planes on the runway and they have those sticks that they wave that are bright?
Sure, yeah.
Like those club glow sticks? It's like if inexplicably, out of nowhere, one of the guys had one stick that was just huge. And so kind of the planes are like, I think that I'm going this way. But it seems weird that there's one baton that's gigantic.
Yeah, oh,
because it's like when you start watching and Milo Ventimiglia is like in the middle of this montage where he's setting up a romantic arc with Midge, you're like, I guess we're going this direction now. And then it fucking doesn't. And you're like, it makes you as a viewer feel insecure.
Sure.
You're watching.
No, I know what you mean, where it's like it just distracting in a way that's probably not worth it. I will skip to a little Twitter Q&A because a listener named Rebecca said, after the highly anticipated yet underwhelming 3 minutes of Milo, who would rather see this? And she writes, you know, a quote from the show, I met him in the park. His dog said hello first. Then he said hello. And Alice, I'm going to share my screen with you right now to show you the image that she made to accompany it. I met him in the park. His dog said hello first. Then he said hello. And Alice made Rebecca made a Photoshop of me with my dog Dexter and Kelly Bishop.
And the way that Dexter's photoshopped in is so like insane and like, ooh, it's so good.
It's very funny. And then there's another
multiple
one.
Multiple ones where I'm in it.
Yeah, where you're Ethan in the park. Rebecca
I
made
am
another
Ethan
one.
In the park.
Hashtag
Thanks,
slot
Rebecca.
Photoshop a reference
I feel fully
to.
Seen.
Yeah, no, that's very nice. And it's me giving Kelly Bishop flowers. No, I think we can all agree that would have been a better experience for the viewer. Because
I wish it was a movie directed by Woody Allen.
Because I'm not famous, so I'm not going to be distracting anybody if they see me. It's just a little wink and a nod. Other things in 407, there a lot of it just feels like riffraff. Overall, do you feel like the second half of this season was stronger than the first half? It's only 8 episodes.
No, I feel like it's all the same.
It's all the same.
I feel, yeah, generally. You know, I think we started off and it was a little weak and then it ended a little weak.
I thought it ended stronger than it ended weaker, but we can get into why or why not that may be. But yes, after the, once again, some implosion with Sophie Lennon, that's not referenced again. A lot of the sort of season that was being set up for us in episode 1 is Midge saying, I want to do things my way. I don't want to do
Tony Bennett.
I don't want to do opening gigs. I don't want to do a gig in, you know, whatever the country was that Susie got for her. Again, this is the Susie Meyerson show through and through. And I think there is this collective feeling, at least peeping on Reddit and in some of the fan communities of, oh, like our central center of protagonist and empathy character is this woman starting a management company and sort of the world that they've built out within the management company where you have the really nice mobsters, Frank and Nikki. They were setting it up to be trouble at first, like, hey, you do a favor for us, we do a favor for you. And you thought that was going to mean like they shake them down or that there is some sort of conflict, but they just seem to be nice little mobstermen that check things out for them. They check out May on behalf of Midge. So things like that, you know, Gideon Glick's character, Dinah, the character who, you know, vacillates between hyper-competent and incompetent, depending on the episode, but does scout out another stand-up for Susie to maybe take on. But the whole thing of this season was, I got to do things my way. But really, and especially as it's framed in the season finale, is, hey, Midge, maybe your way sucks and isn't good, and it's an arbitrary pride issue on your behalf to not take an opening gig and not understanding just legitimately how this business works. The other thing in 407, I don't know if you found this funny, but 407 was just a lot of riffraff in business. They go to a show in which Gideon Glick's magician character hypnotizes Rose, and she does Midge's whole set and talks about her brother jacking off. We see Justin Lupe, Willa from Succession back in the cast, and you're like, oh yeah, Justin Lupe's in this show.
Right.
You fucking forgot about that.
Which, I like her character. I just like it.
Mm-hmm. No. It's always a nice thing to hear.
Yeah. It drives me crazy, the misunderstanding of how stand-up works. I will say, however, the Kennedy Showcase was the funniest I've ever seen Midge. And I thought that was like, I don't know, like the bar for me. It's like, let's do that. Like, she's good here.
Oh, this is the scene in which Midge goes to the fundraiser and does kind of sanitize.
Actually raises some fun. Hello.
Okay, listen up now. Does some material that is squeaky clean about how Jackie Kennedy is awesome and the other maybe potential first lady sucks and looks like a horse or whatever.
Yes.
And that kills. And, you know, she was instructed to keep it clean. And then she ventures into a set in which she describes being the other woman and how bad that must feel. And Jackie Kennedy starts weeping openly at the fundraiser.
Not Jackie. She's
like, that is Jackie.
No, that's...
Uh-oh. Did you not know that was Jackie Kennedy?
I thought that was the lady who's I just assumed that was the lady whose husband it was. It was randomly also at the fundraiser. But that's Jackie Kennedy. That makes total sense.
Why
would funnier.
That woman be at the fundraiser? And we see that woman before. She busted in at the end of that scene, at the beginning of 407.
Right, but like maybe... She also goes to fundraisers. I don't know. That's what I
know.
I thought.
You know, women aren't just one thing, and that's kind of my bad for putting them in a box that way. But no, we are to believe, you know, Miss Jackie Kennedy, another real life figure that Midge has some interaction with on this show. She weeps openly because obviously JFK himself liked a lot of ladies and liked sleeping with them. But I don't know.
How much is Midge Forrest Gump?
I mean, quite a bit as far as like 1960s go in terms of
these. I was doing stand up.
I have to pee. She goes to Vietnam. It's great. She's telling jokes for the troops in Vietnam. Lieutenant Dan. I mean, that's the kind of thing. Whenever you put a historical context on a thing and they do interact with real life figures, of course, there's like there's a Forrest Gump comparison. And she might change the trajectory of Lenny Bruce's whole life, which we'll talk about. So that's a lot of the business in 407. 408, where I imagine we'll spend a lot of our time talking about, was pretty interesting. It feels like one of those things that I remember even when watching Gilmore initially, you'd always look forward to finales just because you knew that it wouldn't be a lot of filler and pablum, but there would be change stakes. And especially in a 22-episode season, you were just so thirsty for it.
Yeah.
In that sort of way. And it's so funny in an 8-episode season to be very thirsty for. I would like the stakes to change a little bit now. So 408, the strip club gets raided. Moesha has a heart attack after Joel tells him, hey, I'm dating this woman named May. She is Chinese. She is pregnant. He drops and has a heart attack at his club. And we do a lot of the same beats of Richard's You May Go First with Emily in season one of Gilmore Girls. When Richard Gilmore goes to the hospital in whatever the Christmas episode is or the winter episode is of that show, and they have that conversation of like, I need to go first. And Richard's like, yes, Emily, you may go first. And there's a lot of who's going to go first talk and conversation between Rose and Abe and then, Shirley and Moesha too. What I liked about this story is that it was an underline of, hey, it's pretty weird that we're all acting as if we're very close family now.
Yes,
that we're in-laws in a way that's, you know, has no tire connection given that our children are divorced and separated. But the kind of weird bond that they've created and the enmeshment in each other's lives to kind of underline that and lampshade that in a creative way, which leads to a lot of tender scenes and dialogue between Shirley and Abe, and Shirley stating to Abe, hey, you know what? If Rose goes first, I'm going to be here and I'm going to take care of you. And it's not a joke. It's not a comedy beat at all. It's just like a very lovely thing to express in a kind of weird relationship that maybe you haven't seen in an episode of TV before.
Yes, it is. And it's like, I also, to support that, Susie going, again, it's your... not at all father-in-law. I don't give a fuck. Why would I? Like, kind of like
yes,
forcing the issue with Midge. Like, literally, what is your life?
mm-hmm. That, yeah. You know? That was nice. It's weird to have these moments, like, whether it's Susie saying that, and of course when Lenny goes off on Midge about, like, why are you doing this? This is such a weird principle where it's like, clearly the show has a perspective within it that, like, hey, this is weird, right? Or you're being kind of dumb or silly.
Right.
But you just kind of, there's a lack of trust sometimes that the show is even in control of those themes or right. knows what it's saying, which is so interesting. And if you outline the different arcs of each of the characters in this season, I don't know what Joel's is other than like, Midge, I'm here. I'm going to be here. You know, it feels like they're setting it up for his and May's romance to implode. Maybe May gets an abortion, or maybe May just ends up not marrying him, and him and Midge end up with each other. Rose's arc, and especially as it ends this season, is, hey, you, Mom, you want a career? I want a career too. I want you to feel empowered the way I feel empowered over the last however many years to do what I want to do. So when all these mafia matchmaker ladies tell you to fuck off, you tell them fuck you and say, I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Which then we get a cutaway to Kelly Bishop's character Benedetta, and she's like, all right, we're going to war, which is a very nice, fun tease for what may come in season 5.
It is.
I look forward to. Kelly Bishop saying we're going to war is just something I've dreamed about a lot in my life.
I imagine that it is your ringtone.
Yeah, it is now. But if you track Abe's arc this season, it mm-hmm. is fucking all oh, yeah. over the place where it's like...
They're relying a lot on I always forget the actor's name.
Tony Shalhoub.
It gets in my head. I'm like, Tony Shalhoub, Tony Shalhoub, Tony Shalhoub. And then the second I say Abe, it disappears. Anyway... So they're really relying heavily, and like I would say needlessly so, on Tony Shalhoub and his ability to just carry water. So like they're like, what if we had him do this? And it's like, I can do that. And what if we have him do this? And it's like, I can do that. And it's like, hey, do you maybe want to just try at all to like make this actor's job possibly any easier? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
he's crazy and he makes it happen and he makes it work within the character, you know, as much as humanly possible, but like, why?
Yeah, that's what's tough about, that's such a good point, where when you have someone of his skill and stature, he can sell anything and it doesn't feel like a stretch at all.
Yeah.
So there's this really nice scene in which, in the finale, he gets really fixated on writing Moesha a proper obituary. He tries to lobby the New York Times to do it.
And this was so confusing because the first time I watched through, I don't really pay attention. It's just in the background. So the first time I watched it through, I was like, Did Moish die?
Did he die?
I'm like, I know, rewinding and going back and forth.
No, I think that's, even if you're watching the first time, maybe a little unclear. And then he reads a lot of it, and it's played as a comedy beat at first, but then it's a very sincere little monologue of like thanks and gratitude. And again, underlying like the weird tenderness of that relationship between these two sets of parents in a way that was... That sort of thing, that kind of got me choked up a little bit. Like Moesha and Abe's little exchange was very sweet to me.
It was very sweet to
me. All that stuff. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now listen, we're all walking around with a lot. You've heard the term, I've got a lot of baggage. Well, we all have a lot of baggage. We have things that we always need to get off our chest, things that are unexpressed, desires, wants, needs. A lot of those are stressors. Big and small. And when we keep them bottled up, it can really start to affect us negatively. And you don't even understand it because you're not tuning into what those things are. But guess what? There's a safe space for you to tune into those things, and it's called therapy. Therapy is where you can figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. I've been working through what's weighing me down for the last 11 years. I'm laughing because now I feel light after working it through. But it's just funny to think, oh yeah, I've been working through it for 11 years. But I gotta tell you something, it's changed and made better pretty much every part of my life. Except for maybe dog training, that's still a little hard. Therapy doesn't really have anything to do with that. But as far as my relationships, my work life, communication, and specifically interpersonal stuff and my own relationship with myself, it's been so, so helpful. I do not know how I would have done the last decade plus without therapy. So if you're thinking about starting therapy, maybe give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Gilmore Guys today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Gilmore Guys. The main thrust, if you will, of this episode is, of course, Lenny and Midge's relationship. The strip club gets raided, and it is the sort of rom-com trope of getting lost in the snow or it's raining outside. We have to take shelter. They go back to his hotel room, And what plays out is a deeply erotic scene. And we've talked about the prism of this through will there or won't they tropes and characters in television history where, of course, like Sam and Diane are the blueprint. You think of Ross and Rachel. You think of Jim and Pam.
Moonlighting.
Yeah, Moonlight, exactly. You think of Cybill Shepherd and Bruce Willis on that show. Maddie and, is it David and Maddie, I think, on that show? And the conventional wisdom is you want them to stay, will they or won't they? If they ever consummate the relationship, of course, the tension and the excitement and the fun of the show gets sucked out. But this show is so different in that it's not like the central relationship of the show is will Lenny and Midge get together? It's just this sort of juice that Amy, I think properly so, instinctually followed of like, oh, I casted one of the most insanely charismatic men alive to inhabit, not do an impression, but inhabit Lenny Bruce, where it's like, what if Lenny Bruce was fucking hot? And so someone who is maybe supposed to be in one or two episodes in season one is like,
yeah,
I guess I'll have my main character have sex with this real life person.
Right.
At the end of season four, it got played around with maybe a little bit in season three, but it happens in this season finale. They consummate their relationship and have sex in his hotel room in this very kind of lovely, very hot, very erotic seduction scene. In which the
it definitely
thing,
had Midge's brother running to the bathroom.
Oh, listen, Midge's brother had new material for his 1958 spank bank. Uh-huh. Here I go. And the way that played out, Luke Kirby's ability to look at his scene partner, and I would say Rachel Brosnahan's ability to do the same, it did make me long for, again, the 90-minute rom-com that Amy Sherman Palladino makes one day, in which it's like, if you tell this story and do this sort of...
Oh my God, like bliss, absolute bliss. Like really, really a return to the rom-com of the 90s that we all sort of idealize and like maybe something, an elevation of that, that we need. And I haven't seen anything like that since like The Long Shot.
Yeah, The Long Shot, the Seth Rogen, Charlize Theron movie that came out a couple years ago.
Yeah.
That was like very tender. This scene was very tender. And what was so incredible about it to me too is that instead of just generic sort of seduction, is this going to happen conversation, it was so specific to the arcs of the characters. This is so hard to do. Maybe it's not that hard to write a scene like this where it's like these two hot people want to be hot together and smash. But to do it where it's like this is integral to the point of Miriam Maisel, the point of my own autonomy, my own integrity as an artist, as a stand-up, and then also my own wants and needs and feelings as a woman and just as a human being. And those things where she says, don't you dare ever think I'm not funny. Like, and underlying that, which is, you know, she's putting in those terms, what she's actually saying is like, I'm your peer. I am a professional. I'm not fucking my way to the top. I want that to be absolutely clear.
I do. I want that to be absolutely clear. So I wanted her to say that. Like, I didn't understand it the first time she said, I'm funny. Like, I didn't like it. I hated the dialogue. And then when she later reiterates it to her and goes, this is what you were saying when you said that. I'm like, oh, thanks, Lenny, for finally explaining to me because I didn't fucking get it. I was like, I'm funny? Okay.
I think that's what it meant.
Like,
yeah,
she should have said, I'm a comic. Like, I'm not so any of that needed to be there for me, at least. Because I just was like, what is her reservation? So, because to me...
Timmy, do you go off quick?
I keep saying, making this point over and over, and I've broken record, but like, you're a comic, you don't need to say I'm funny. Like, I say I'm funny, but it's like a tongue-in-cheek ironic thing. Like, I just don't understand why you'd be like, in that context, like, I'm funny. Like, unless it's like a, you're not funny and you think you're not funny, so you got to say, I don't know, it's weird.
Well, maybe it's like a little piece of insecurity that she still has where she's still trying to convince herself or him of the...
I don't think so because we don't see her be insecure about that ever. She's like, I'm the greatest and I'll always be the great... Like, whatever. I don't... It doesn't jive for me. So I get that she might want to think that as her... Like, the reason she hasn't slept with him is that, like, that makes total sense to me. Like, I haven't slept with this guy even though I want to smash because it's... scary for me to involve to shit where I eat type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And like almost to be involved with him like that, you're going to have to like, yeah, set up some ground rules. So yeah, she's doing that. But like, I'm funny. I don't understand that that's a ground rule. It's like, okay, yeah, of course you're funny. He thinks you're funny. What about that?
I don't know. That's just I guess the way it read for me was just respect me. I'm a person. Obviously, you've slept with a lot of the women that I worked with at this you know, burlesque club, but right. I'm not that. I'm someone who you need to respect and admire. And he does, you know, even in that scene, say, you're more important than God. And to her, that's like a sign of respect of like, you were, and she says that. She says, oh, you were listening, because she did a sort of confessional Nanette-esque set at the burlesque club.
Definitely invented Nanette.
She invented Nanette. She did it right there in 1960, where she talks about, you know, are women in charge? All that stuff I found to be like interestingly written and obviously, and I know you may say, and I probably agree, like not realistic and not what maybe.
But I don't mind that. I don't mind that at all. Like the audience is quiet. Often for me, it's like, it comes down to the audience being written poorly and like, what is an audience and what is, you know what I mean? Like, what is the, cause to me, like stand-up comedy is about an audience. It's not about like, you know what I mean? Like we have to see, the audience is a character and they don't care for the character at all. They don't give any, like any credence. There's no rhyme or reason to what audiences in this show do or don't do. So that to me is like, that's, if I had to fix one thing about this show, that's what it would be for me. Is like, let's write a logic about like what is the audience of 1959? What do they care about? What are they thinking? What are these, this group of people? And are there different personalities to different parts of the city? Like, let's think about it and then let's obey those rules. But I did like the confessional and I thought it was apt and I thought it was well placed. It made sense for her to go into that there and her emotion was where it was and I liked it. And Lenny sees it and responds to it, and I think that was all good.
Now, the kind of trope that we've talked about where it's like, when will they or won't they characters consummate, the tension sucked out, then The Office becomes boring if Jim and Pam are together and they're happily ever after. The thing
but
about
not if Jim dies of a heroin overdose.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is the thing that didn't
in
happen.
Fact, I do want to see that version of The Office.
The thing that didn't happen on The Office is Pam did not go into Jim's bathroom and say, hey, are you a heroin addict? Are you literally addicted to a drug that will kill you in 4 years?
Yeah. And then Jim looks at the camera like,
uh-oh. Yeah, he kind of like does his little muggy face. That's so funny.
And then nods off.
Yeah. That sort of stakes where it's like already the consummation of it feels like a different story to tell in the history of these kind of couples on TV, because you know there's no future. It will end poorly as far as like there's not even a question like, are they going to get together? They're not. He is going to die very soon.
Yeah. He
will go first. Yeah, they should have had that conversation. But that part of it was fascinating to me. This leads to the set that he does at Carnegie Hall. They shot the real life fucking Carnegie Hall, this gorgeously shot thing. Again, where I'm like, yeah, Amy's like a fucking director.
Yeah.
She's not just a lady who's doing her, you know, like her own script. It's like, she knows how
and
to
when
block.
Ladies just do their own script.
Like, when ladies do their own script, well, you know.
They do
I should,
be doing their own script. Ladies do.
I didn't mean that in a strange gendered way, you know.
One
thing
about
ladies
is they do be
script.
Shopping, and then they do be doing their own
Jesus.
Script.
So this is a real life set. This is a real life set that Lenny Bruce did at Carnegie Hall in 1960. You can find recordings of it.
I know
on
you can
streaming.
Because of the way that it was shot and performed. Mm-hmm. I knew going into it when I was listening to the guy doing the intro, I was like, "This is the real intro." Mm-hmm. I mean, why am I bragging about it? But I'm saying it was so well done. I mean, and the way that it was shot so specifically and that they used the real intro, like I was like, okay, so he's going to be doing the real show.
Yeah. And I think all that stuff is really fun when you see it played well in movies or TV shows that play with historical context where obviously you know this event and we're telling this fictional story. But okay, there's this recording. It's Lenny Bruce doing his hour and a half or whatever at Carnegie Hall. But man, you know, there's that bit in there where he talks about divorced women and living with their moms. And then that kind of makes some of the conflict that they had in one of the previous episodes where he wakes up in her home you know, with Ethan running around and her parents and the, like, kind of filling in those gaps that doesn't just, like, change reality to become a yeah. joke in service of the show. It's like, well, what if there's a woman there? What if there was ooh, a yeah. fellow comic that, ooh, and she was in the audience? And it's just, like, that sort of thing is such a funny yes. idea. Mm. And I thought was, like, very successfully executed and very well done. That's something where, like, they spent a lot of time on it and they spent a lot of time in his set where it's like, yeah, you would. And I really enjoyed the kind of level of care and attention paid to that. That does lead to his why did you drop out of Tony Bennett?
Why did you drop out of Tony Bennett's show?
But I want to play a little bit of their argument.
How did it feel?
How did it feel? It felt great.
Been here before to see concerts, but out in the audience, obviously.
I hear you turned down the Bennett gig.
Yeah, I did.
Said you wouldn't even come to the phone.
Well, that was more Susie, but yes.
Okay. Let's put aside for a moment that I went to bat for you for that job. I mean, really, I turned down that price 3 times. No, she can't work for that. Do you have any idea what you're getting here? That's on me. You didn't ask me to do that, so I'm the schmuck there.
Lenny.
But I couldn't really figure out why, so I asked around. I don't know, were you being blacklisted again? Did the Baldwin thing hurt you that much? I'm at Carnegie Hall. I've got 5 minutes where maybe I can help you before I'm thrown out of the club again. But then I heard that you were turning down gigs right and left.
I made a decision to do things my way.
I'm sorry, what does that mean?
It means I just want to say what I want to say. Why am I explaining this to you?
Why? Because my fucking mind is blown, that's why.
I don't understand.
No opening act gigs.
Yes.
That's true?
Yes, that's true. I told you about the manifesto.
Do you understand that this is a business? Like anything else, you get hired, you get paid, you understand that?
Yes, but...
And the trick is to get good and get paid.
I get paid at the Wolford.
Oh, come on, one thing you are not is dumb.
Wait a minute, you never compromise. You get up on stage knowing the police could be there, or hell, that they are there, and you say whatever the hell it is you want anyhow. Why is it wrong for me to want to do the very
Jesus
same thing?
Jesus Christ, Midge, what a fucking pedestal you put me on. Getting arrested is not a badge of honor. Getting arrested means I can't work where I want to work. People are afraid of booking me. It's exactly the opposite of what I want for myself.
But...
Do you know how much I hate knowing that half the people that come to see me are hoping I'm going to get popped? Hoping they'll have some great story to tell their friends over cheese and crackers? I want people to fucking laugh. Think and laugh, sure, but laugh. I'm a comic, an entertainer, baggy pants, banana peels. I'm not a stand-up messiah. This is what I want. This is what I have worked for. Don't you want this? Don't you want to be here? Don't you want to know 1,000 mental patients brave the fucking snowstorm to see you? That should be the goal.
How do you know it's not?
Because you're not going to get here hiding yourself away in a club that technically doesn't exist.
I'm not hiding.
You sure as fuck are hiding. So what, you got dumped by Baldwin? Who gives a shit? Go get another gig and another and another.
So I'm just supposed to get fired from one job after another?
Yes, if that's what it takes. Listen to me. I have made a lot of mistakes and I'm going to keep making a lot of mistakes, but one thing is crystal clear in my mind and it's what the end game is.
Oh, really? So that's what the bagging
is? No! Do not make this about me. This is about you. You wanted me to remember you're funny, right? That night? You didn't want me to think of you as just a girl. You wanted me to think of you as a comic. Well, don't you forget that I'm a comic too. Don't you dare look at me as someone to be pitied or helped or fixed. I do not want or need that, especially from you.
I don't want to fix you.
90% of this game is how they see you. They see you hanging with Tony Bennett. They think you deserve to be there. They see you hauled off to jail for saying fuck at a strip club. They think you deserve that also. Wise up.
I'm not hiding. I have a plan.
Don't plan. Work. Just work and keep working. There is a moment in this business, windows open. If you miss it, it closes. Just don't. If you blow this, Midge, I swear. You will break my fucking heart.
Huh. Okay.
What are you thinking?
Will she break your heart? Okay. Okay. Did not know you were that invested, but okay. Sounds good. Also, why do you care so much about this person? Like, first half of the speech, I am absolutely living. I'm like, drag her, Lenny. Because it's all the stuff that hasn't made any sense about Midge's dumb thing. It's about her privilege, her endless, endless, like, fucking high-horsed, like, I'm doing things my way. And it's, like, the most Karen-y bullshit that ever existed. And Lenny's like, what the fuck are you talking about? And it feels so good to have somebody say it. And then the second half is, like, he goes on and on and on. And you're like, yeah, but, like, is it – like, I hate how she's been so much and how her dumb attitude – you know, I've lost so much patience with Midge that, like, I'm like, but Lenny's better than Midge. Like, why does he care? Like, she's not that funny. Like, why do, you know what I mean? Like, that's, I know some of the Twitter Q&A is like, do you even like the show? Why are you talking about it? But let's go back to the very beginning of us watching this show and how exciting it was to have this be the subject of this, you know, like, I wanted to be in this show. I was so excited. Just the concept of it was so interesting to me. And, like, we've fallen so far. So that is where my frustration with Midge comes from. So, like, I don't know. I would give it 2, maybe 3 out of 5 hats.
Oh, we're rating the scene?
At the album. Because it does feel really good to have somebody point out how ludicrous her, like, plan is. And I also liked the moment, and I don't know if this is deliberate or not, where she goes, you read the manifesto. I love that part because it's like, oh, she sounds so immature. So that sounds, it was so weak, her saying, you read the manifesto. Like, you should never, ever say to somebody, like, you read the manifesto in that tone of voice. Do you know what I mean? Like, you should never be like, no, you read the manifesto. Like, it's like, oh, okay, that makes it sound like you're a child playing in a sandbox. You know, you don't know what this is about. You don't know the stakes here at all. You're not taking this seriously at all. And it is disrespectful to Lenny to like goof around. Like, this is your, is it your side gig? Is it your passion? Is it your thing? You know what I mean? Like, you're playing around with Lenny and it's a disrespect. Like, it's a disrespect to the audience. I think the audience in the show and the audience by extension at home. It's a disrespect to the audience to fuck around with their time. Like, what does this fucking person we're watching spending, what is it, 60 hours at this point with? Like, what does this person care about? Why am I to care? Why am I spending my time giving a flying fuck about what Midge wants? When we don't even know what she wants, and I'm not confident that the writers of the show know what she wants. So to have Lenny come along and be like, what the fuck are you doing? Is like, yes, ah.
So that was the first half. How did you respond to the second half of what he was saying?
Yeah, the second half was like, now it's like they have to put in there like that his heart is gonna break if she flubs this. And I'm just a little unconvinced by that because at this moment they've been kind of like friends and, you know, he's been mentory to her, but not that mentory. It feels like something Sophie Lennon could say, but you know what I mean? And you'd go, what? But to me, it's like, this is a Susie line. If you flub this, you're going to break my heart. Because, you know what I mean? That's what Susie should have said to Midge, not Lenny.
Yeah, that makes sense given the kind of longevity of Susie and Midge's relationship.
Yeah, and that's not Midge and Lenny's relationship to me. It hasn't been set up that like that for me.
Yeah, you think it's more playful, more light, that there's probably not that much investment there.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. I see that. It was interesting to me that the way in which he talked about his heart being broken was not, it was absolutely immaterial to whatever romantic, relational, or sexual connection that they had. That
true.
His investment was not in that. Maybe it leaked in a little bit, obviously, because she's a person that he cares about on a personal level, whether he wants to or not. But that the heartbreak was put in terms of, again, professional respect, I think, is a nice idea. And again, it's imagining a world where it's like, this person exists, Lenny Bruce exists, but, you know, what if this is something he cared about? And just like a slight peek behind the curtain of, I don't enjoy being a social justice martyr, maybe in the way that like popular media narratives. I would rather just sell out Carnegie Hall, and I'm desperate to, and I want to acknowledge the sort of business aspect of this profession. In my relationship with the audience feels like a little intractably, oh, it's fun that he's the controversial guy, when it's like, you know what? I'd rather just be, you know, I think that's always a powerful story beat whenever someone says, I don't like this about myself. You know, it's like, oh, okay. You know, and this thing you sort of took for granted about what's true about a character is like, oh, maybe there's like something more to it. In the same way that like the viewer might have had a relationship with the character of Lenny Bruce, of he's just sort of this freewheeling guy, and he's kind of this angel of 1950s, 60s stand-up that pops in, pops out, and just glides all around. And there starts to be little tears in that in an interesting way, where it's like, wait, you have a kid? I didn't know you had a kid. And she was talking about a couple episodes ago. And even his way of saying, don't put me up on a pedestal, almost as a rebuke to what the popular imagination of is of him, even as a character within the context of this show, where it's like, listen, I just want to make money. And I'm not here to, like, I'm not here to be Jon Stewart. I am actually a clown. I would rather just be a clown. And yeah, I want to make people think. And of course, I'm fucking around with all these weighty social themes. But yeah, I just want to make people laugh. And by neglecting the sort of...
I love that. I loved his whole speech so much, because it really made me... I identified. I was like, TBH, same.
Oh, yeah?
The whole thing. I was like, I want to make people laugh. Think and laugh, yeah, but laugh. Like, and then I have to say, like, it affected me. Like, it spoke to me personally, because I'm really struggling right now. I stopped filming Resident Alien. Like, my last day, my wrap day was yesterday.
Okay.
And I've got to pack up my whole apartment. I've got to go back down to LA, and I'm excited. I'm excited to live with my boyfriend again. I'm excited to live with my two sons. But, like... I'm also full of anxiety, because I have no idea. Like, I haven't done stand up. I haven't done anything. I haven't been like, and I'm full of anxiety about it. And when he said, "Am I gonna cry right now because of a Lenny Bruce?"
You can cry.
Okay, I am emotional because I rapped last night, so like, I'm gonna give myself that. But when he said, "Like, don't plan work," it was like, "Oof, I needed that, Lenny. Thank you."
I know. It's such a nice...
It was like he was speaking to me directly. Like, and it was so... Luke Kirby is so amazing, because it was so like, come here, baby girl. Come here, chickadee. Like, fucking, this is what you need to do. And I'm like... And somebody on Twitter said, is there a heroine in the ASP universe that doesn't have... I think this is from our Q&A. Like, that doesn't have her epiphany brought to her by a man. And like, yes... Like, go off, queen. That's a great question. But at the same time, when that is such a trope in so many, like, garbage rom-coms where women have their emotional overturn because of some guy telling them to, ASP does it good. Like, she does it really properly. The guy sees the person in the woman, you know? He sees the human, and he, like, and I wonder whether or not there is a Daniel Amy thing going on there, because it's so real when they write it. It's so like, this is a guy who's there to support. He's like, no, bitch, like, you fucking need this. Like, you're bigger than this. And I'm here to make sure. Like, I'm going to fucking lay down my coat on every puddle right now, because, you know, and it's so like, it's hot, right? And
unequivocal support from a man professionally that is a holistic value of the woman rather than just how the woman relates to the man is beautiful, because it's like he starts in protest saying, I put my neck out and I really, you know, negotiated a good fee for you and you didn't even take the phone call. So it starts in that like, hey, you kind of messed me up in that way. And that's germane to the relationship. But think about the last echo of seeing this sort of thing in an Amy piece. This is season 6 of Gilmore Girls, when Jess is no longer a character in the show. He flies in for 2 episodes in season 6, and Rory's dropped out of Yale. She's messing around with Logan, stealing boats, living in the pool house with her grandparents. And his whole thing is, this isn't you. We used to make fun of guys like this. Why did you drop out of Yale? And because Jess was set up as like, I know you, I've known you since Stars Hollow, I've known you since high school. Also, I'm not trying to, I mean, he was romantically invested in her at a time, but it's like, this isn't about me trying to get action or to be with you in a way. This is me just like, I really love you and I really care about you in these ways that you're affecting and maybe damaging your own trajectory in your own life. That's what it is. And I understand, especially for Amy to write that, you might be onto something in that there must be some sort of relational, you would hope that there's people in her lives and in all of our lives that are like, hey, I love you. This isn't about me. Take me out of the equation. What's going on with you? And I don't care if you hate me a little bit for that right now, but I would love to talk with you and engage you in this way where it's like,
yeah,
I want such good things for you.
It feels like that moment in an old movie when the guy comes up to the woman and she's all hysterical and he shakes her and she's like, you know, and he shakes her and he's like, what's got into you? But then after, in a 50s movie, imagine a guy going like, get a hold of yourself, Phyllis, what's got into you? You're a writer. You're a writer and you have a whole career ahead of you. I won't let you give up. It's like, wait, what? What movie is this?
it's a good movie. I don't know. I didn't see that one, but wow. It sounds good.
Crazy. What's got into you, Philip? Philip? What's got into you, Philip?
She's Philip?
I'm Philip.
That's cool. Oh, it's him signing his name. What's gotten into you, Philip?
What's gotten into you, Philip? You got a cold or something? I'm asking my own immune system.
Yeah, so that sort of thing. Also, I don't know. I wonder if it's hard or easy to act a scene out like that in a big, cavernous, real location like Carnegie Hall. Because it's just
easy.
These two actors. You think it's easy?
Easier.
I mean, certainly easier than talking to ping pong balls on green screens, but
Ping pong balls.
So
actually, I don't know about that. Like I sometimes do the best when I'm just either if I'm not with an actor that I like have chemistry on some level with, you know what I mean? Like I don't mean sexy chemistry. I mean the kind of like we're both here to, you know, support each other, yada yada, and we can feel it. It's like I'd like to act with a ping pong ball. I'd like to see what happens.
I hope you do act with a ping pong ball.
Thank you.
So after this, Midge goes back out to the blizzard, walks through the snow, sort of hallucinates seeing go forward on a sign. And this is them just like flexing and burning the rest of the Amazon budget on really expensive exterior fake snow and blizzard setup. And I'm sure a lot of digital effects too. But the last thing she sees is Gordon Ford, the Gordon Ford big billboard as played by Reed Scott, the talk show host. This is the person that the Town Booker, as played by her real-life husband, Rachel Brosnahan's real-life husband, Jason Ralph. That's the thing Susie's been trying to get her into. It's like, I don't know, like, they need to see you performing at a real place. Obviously, the Copa would be a real place. Tony Bennett opening for him at the Copa would be a real place. The season ends with her walking towards the sign. And I kind of don't know. It's one of the more elliptical endings for an ASP show. A finale for an ASP season where is the idea I will make right and kind of swallow my pride and these sort of arbitrary principles I've set up for myself. I'm going to try to be a television writer. Some people speculated in the Reddit, and do that path towards careerdom. I will, you know, open to interpretation.
Oh, I thought it meant she was going to, you know, try to start designing billboards.
Am I going to design three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri and ask Chief Willoughby how come?
Uh-huh.
I've got some things to say. That's my Francis. Sit down. I have some things to say. Love her. Or do I? I don't know. Here's the thing with Frances McDormand real quick.
Oh, boy. Here we go. This is a hot take.
She's obviously, like, I'm not dumb. She's an amazing actor. But because of all the campaigning she's done for Oscar stuff in the last 5 or 6 years, between Three Billboards and Nomadland, she's now crossed over from actor, character actor. Oops, sorry, that was me. She's now crossed over from that space to movie star, where you're familiar with who she is. I'm no nonsense. I don't have anything done to my face. I don't really give a shit. And she looks pissed off every time she wins an Oscar. So you think about that, and then you apply that ethos to the characters she plays.
Right.
And I, in my own personal viewing of her stuff, have sensed some condescension, where it's like, oh, this is a person in the Midwest. They don't really know what's going on. I'm going to play them like that. You know, like, I sense a distance from this very uppity, super extra, fucking bread on the treading the boards theater lady married to a humorless man in Joel Cohen. And then I'm like, when you're playing Van Lady, you're probably like, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I'm sensing a little bit of judgment in those characters now.
I think, yeah.
That said, obviously she's a terrific actor.
I think there's always judgment when people play. I'm never comfortable with the, you know, hillbilly elegy. Like, I do not like to see big stars. Big
poverty stars cosplay. Playing. Yeah.
Oof.
It's tough.
Because if it's an unknown actor, it's not even about, they could be the richest person alive, but like, if it's an unknown actor, somebody I'm not familiar with their like legacy on screen, like, it's so much easier for me to like have them play these characters. And like, but when you see it's Amy Adams, you're like, all right, this is insulting.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
To someone.
It's a movie star problem. I think we should do some Twitter Q&A.
Tweet.
I'm getting I can almost be identical, I think.
I think you could. By the way, shouts out to Julie Klausner, who played the woman across the way in The Window that was yelling
Julie
things.
Klausner?
That was Julie freaking Klausner, who I thought was very funny on the show. She did a little post about it, I think, either on Twitter or Instagram.
I'm so glad that she did that, because I love Julie Klausner to death as a human being and comedian, like, forever. She's a solid gold person. And
if you're not familiar with her stuff, you can listen to the Double Threat podcast she does with Tom Sharpling, or watch Difficult People on Hulu.
Or read her book, I Don't Care About Your Band. It's amazing.
Yes. I have a funny story about that book I have to tell you off mic.
Ooh. Tweet.
Carrie did Why Did You Drop Out of the Tony Bennett Show? Her question, Oi with the recycling already. Jamie wrote in, is ASP trying to communicate something with the loss of so many hats this season? I love the idea that a character's like emotional state can be tracked in the presence or absence of hats.
Oh.
Which was very funny.
Oh, no question. Because Amy always wears a hat, so it's like really important to her.
I know. I wish the Paladinos would freaking bite the bullet.
The therapy?
No, that's not what I was going to say. I was going to say, do the architectural home digest house tour. Do it. Do the YouTube thing. Do what Vanessa Hudgens and Dakota Johnson do and open up the home. I want to see the pink. I want to see the hat racks. I want to see Daniel's little vinyl corner that he's allowed to play in, you know, after bedtime.
I want
to see it all. Tree WK, I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce your name, but with all the Gilmore crossover, do you think the actors not asked to be on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel,
I love this question,
are at home taking it personally? Because it's so prevalent now. It is a good question of, you know, Rose Abdu or Keiko. I mean, Keiko's working. She's fine. But like, you know, are they like, why am I not in this show? Literally everyone else is, which is such a funny idea.
Well, I think that about every show anyway, about myself. So there's no question to me that they are. Because like, if I think that about every show that I'm not on, even though I'm not part of the legacy of that, I just can't imagine they're not thinking that, which is amazing to me. And I love it. Not for schadenfreude, just for like the way Hollywood works.
Of course. It's always going to be cafeteria table politics. And I was having a conversation actually with a mutual friend of ours where it's like, it is so embarrassing that still at this age or older, that the feeling is, oh no, I'm feeling left out and not included now.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Oof. It's embarrassing, but it's just, I don't know, whatever.
Pervasive.
It's pervasive, and it's like maybe an eternal, endless FOMO we'll always feel. Brett asked a very good question. They said, when the Maisels all die in a freak Ferris wheel accident, will Amy reboot May and her teenage daughter in the 70s as Gil May girls?
I hope just for the Asian community's sake that she does not do that.
It's a show specifically about Asian culture with an all white writing staff.
Oof. No, they hire Asian writers. They just do not listen to them.
That'd be interesting. I know the Jewishness of this season. There were, you know, in 407 there was the runner of Abe snuck into a Catholic church. He accidentally took communion, but didn't really, and then he brings the body of Christ, the wafer, home. I think sometimes, like, we have talked about the white privilege on the show and just, like, flatly coded it as white. I think I'm trying to, even when I was watching these episodes, it wasn't super salient other than that scene, but trying to interrogate, like, Jewish identity in the 1960s as, you know, listen, as Goyim, but, like, trying to understand it in a way that's more sensitive in understanding Jewish community as a marginalized community, because I think that's something that sometimes we can gloss over.
Oh yeah,
in a way that might be insensitive.
And we're writing about a group of people that were like not just like persecuted during, like, literally the Holocaust happened not that long ago in reality, but also in the show,
right? In,
like, there's living escapees walking among and part of their community. And
yeah, to them that would be the Bush era. To us now, that's how long ago it was, which is like, oh yeah, that was like a couple of years ago. That was like 9/11, you know, in terms of like historical memory. And
right, it's the first Iraq war.
Mm-hmm. It's the first Iraq war, like, yeah, so. 2003. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the last question was, Tina wrote in and said, is it just me, or was there a lot of music recycled from Gilmore Girls, Bunheads on this season of Maisel? Do you think the show suffers from Sam Phillips' absence? So Sam Phillips was the composer, singer-songwriter, composer for a lot of the La La tracks, and kind of the voice of Gilmore Girls in addition to all the needle drops. This is a needle drop forward show, Maisel is. So, and it's all basically period appropriate, except when they do a little anachronisms for the end credits. But I did notice, because I do believe they have used someone to watch over me in one of the, either in another episode of Bunheads or Gilmore, or even within Maisel, so maybe it's a motif. But I noticed a lot of very on the nose sort of needle drops. So, we're looking at all the matchmakers and Abe is getting intimidated by them at the store. So they're playing matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match, like that sort of thing where I'm like, yeah, it's like just like a word cloud.
Right.
There's not a lot that are counterintuitive or interesting in that sort of way. It's still fun and like interesting to listen to, just because it'll always feel novel for a period show to use only period music. But it is something I notice a little bit more, I think, in this season.
I'm not that attentive to that, so I didn't notice it, and I don't know how much the real, like, audience is attentive to that, so I can't really speak to it, because I think it's fine. I think the needle dropness of it works almost always pretty well. For me, at least.
Yeah.
It didn't, at one point, there was a little bit like extra jazz on something that I didn't feel it needed it, but otherwise.
Hey, you talking extra jazz? It's me, Ryan Gosling from La La Land.
Oof.
I heard you were talking jazz and I decided to Zoom bomb the call.
That's then somebody's being extra about jazz.
All right, so that's season four. That's season four of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
That was all the Twitter Q&A?
That was a good amount of it.
I had my own Twitter Q&A.
Other things we basically covered, or, you know, Emily brought up this question of, like, I feel like I'm watching a series of bottle episodes. What plot points do you think will carry through to the next season? What will be completely forgotten about? And I have no sense for this anymore, just because the things that you thought were closed threads, like, you know, they, you know, closed the loop on it. Like Sophie Lennon stuff, they're like, hey, just kidding, here's some more of that. So
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, they could open season five and guess what? Gordon Ford is canceled and he doesn't have a show anymore. There's, you know, like, it could be anything. I'm not sure. It's a little chaotic, but it's something that the Paladinos talk about, at least in their sit down with the Hollywood Reporter. The question is, how's ending the series now up the stakes for what's to come in season five. How is it going to up the stakes for season five? Amy says the point of anything is to stick the landing no matter what. So I don't know that it ups the game any more than it would have upped the game if we had gone six or seven seasons. When it came down to five and out, we sat down and said, okay, now what do we do to make sure that we stick the landing? Because that's the most important thing. We've invested so much time and energy and resources in these people and their journeys. Mm-hmm. The bar is just making sure that we put this cast through what we put them through and made them work as hard as they did, and that they get to come out of this feeling like they've made a good journey and that their characters have traveled and ended someplace of worth. So that's not at all pressure. We're just slogging through and being very meticulous. We're really paying attention to our story bringing process to make sure that everybody is given their moment and given their due time and space. So we're going to be in a sort of hyper panic fog until September, which I think is when they'll wrap shooting on the show or wrap post on it.
I can't imagine. What are they going to do after they're in a hyper panicked fog? Do they just go into stasis?
Yeah, they'll probably go on vacation or something. I don't know. I don't know if Literally they travel. I don't know if they're vacation people.
Into like the they're like stasis chambers that are shaped like the genie bottle from I Dream of Genie.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they go back into the bottle until Amazon comes a calling again.
I have one more Twitter Q&A. Roma Joy.
Sure.
As the casting director for the Super Mario's movies, which Maisel characters would you cast as which Mario characters? Smash Brothers also acceptable.
Oh, I did write that down, but I didn't know if you were familiar. Oh, wait, we've played Smash Brothers. What the hell am I talking about? You and I have literally played Smash Brothers. I'm so sorry, Alice. Casting director, which Maisel characters would you cast as Mario characters?
Like, okay, let's start with something simple, Princess Peach.
Okay, obviously Midge is Peach. Midge is Peach. Kelly Bishop is Bowser. Obviously Susie's Toad.
Imogene's not Peach? Because I feel like Imogene's very Peach. She's super Peach.
Imogene is Yoshi.
Oh, Imogene is Yoshi.
And Abe is Mario because of the freaking mustache.
Zendaya is Michi. Imogene is Yoshi.
That's right. And Imogene is Yoshi. And Zendaya is Michi. And then for the rest of them, I gotta go. I gotta go. My guy Joel is just a Koopa. He's a Koopa in the cloud. He just needs to be floating up there and be semi-helpful every now and again. I don't need him trying to be Luigi. I want to say Abe is Mario and Moisha is Luigi. And you know what? Just for good measure, Shirley can be Daisy. Daisy is the other princess that's not Peach. Put that on your plate.
What about those ground stomper guys?
Oh, a Goomba?
A Goomba.
Oh, the Goomba is obviously Jackie, R.I.P.
Who'd you say? Yeah, that's what I thought too. Who'd you say Bowser was?
I said Kelly Bishop for Bowser, but that's just me wanting to have my way.
No, I think it's Sophie Lennon.
Yeah. Sophie Lennon as a Bowser is probably a good punch up.
Yeah, I don't hate that.
The way that Amy frames that in this interview of we want to do right and make sure that the actors feel good about what we put them through. It's such an interesting responsibility that I haven't thought about in terms of showrunners and, you know, however much just PR, whatever she's doing in that moment. It's such an interesting idea of like, look, we have a relationship with these people. And then you do imagine different cast members' faces when they get their different scripts. And on one hand, you can imagine Alex Borstein being like, all right, this is going to be challenging, but great. I can't wait to do it. I get a lot of fun stuff to do. The camera zooms in on me. I get to play a thing I didn't get to play on my Getting On show on HBO. You imagine Tony Shalhoub kind of just, okay, what am I doing in this one?
Yes,
in his trailer.
Hondo P.
You know,
Hondo
like you do. It's it's funny to put it through that prism.
Yes.
But sounds like they're aware of the... You know, and it's still going to be a COVID season, but it's going to be a post-vaccine COVID season, season five, when it comes out. So I wonder how much we will or won't feel that. That part of it will be very interesting.
Yeah, it will
be. Is that factor. Because maybe they'll travel, maybe they'll have huge crowds, but it's just...
They go to Tahiti.
Yeah, they go to Tahiti. The finale is in the Ukraine, and they shoot there. It's a live special.
Zelensky cameo.
Yeah. Oh, Zelensky cameo. Maybe he's a little stand-up. He's funny. He is a stand-up, you know, or he's a comedian or whatever.
Yeah, I know that. He's like, stand-up can be bigger than just.
That's right. So that's season four. That's season four of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goys. Alice, how do you feel? We completed the journey in four episodes over 5 weeks.
Some satisfying stuff happened for me. Something, some questions.
There's always moments of transcendence where it's like, hell yeah.
I think they're going to have May become Jewish.
Yeah, you think so? She'll convert?
Yeah.
That's interesting. We'll see. Stephanie Sue, there's this movie coming out, you know, actually the weekend that this episode comes out. It'll come out the Friday before, but it's called Everything, Everywhere, All of the Time, I believe. Mm-hmm. It's this movie by the Daniels, who did Swiss Army Man, and it stars Michelle Yeoh, whose agent did, for real, email me about voice acting for Super Mario. That really did happen. But Stephanie Sue is in the movie. Stephanie Sue is playing a supporting character. I don't know the nature of her role, but I was delighted to see her in the movie. And I heard from a friend of mine who's connected to the Daniels, the directors of the movie. One of the Daniels said, we wanted Awkwafina for that role, but Awkwafina, for whatever reason, that didn't happen. So we had Stephanie Sue. And then I imagine Awkwafina's filmography replaced every role she's done with Stephanie Sue in it. And yeah. I enjoy those projects. Perhaps, I don't know, 400% more in that imagination. I don't believe Stephanie Sue is a legacy of black scent and black voice that she's done. And I believe she has phenomenal comic timing. And I love her.
I think she has phenomenal comic timing. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think you have phenomenal comic timing.
And
Alice.
I think you have phenomenal comic
and
timing.
And I think you, and I love you so
and
much.
And under your chair, you'll find more phenomenal comic timing.
All right. Is it time to get the hell out of here?
I think so.
Okay, let's go out with the song, How Do I Get to Carnegie Hall by Sparks, which is how this season of television ends. Because you see, Midge wants to get to Carnegie Hall, and she went to Carnegie Hall, and that's why we did it.
I love Sparks, to be honest, I have to say.
And we'll see you next season on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, guys. Thank you for listening. We love you. Thanks for going on the journey. Thanks for bearing with us. Thanks for it all. Thanks for your questions, your comments, your emails. We love you. Thank you. And good night.
Good night, guys.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.